I think now's as good a time as any to get going. First of all, thank you to everyone who has joined. This is an evening with Red Bull featuring Blake and Dan, aka Breakin, Engine Mode 11. This is the first ever Reddit talk we've done on the subreddit. If things go wrong, you're all here for the experience. Hopefully, we'll have a great time. And this is completely interactive. So, we did have a thread on the subreddit. There are some questions there, which we'll be asking our two guests, who will introduce themselves shortly. If you do have a question, much like a Twitter space, just raise your hand and we're going to attempt to give you speaking rights. You'll be able to ask a question to either Blake or Dan and we'll take it from there. So I'll be, I guess, kind of the host tonight in LP228. I'm one of the mods here on the sub. To make sure things go smoothly, to give you admin rights, we've also got Yefe. Do you want to give a quick hi, Yefe?
I can figure out how to unmute myself. Yeah, hello, everyone.
I just wanted to ask, how are you feeling now that K-Mag is back? Because for those of you that don't know, you are the biggest K-Mag fan I've ever met.
I am. I'm very, very happy he's back. I could spend at least the next 6 to 8 hours talking about how excited I am to have him back on the grid and actually have him in a car that seems like it's you know, able to compete with the rest of them.
Okay, well, let's see how this Reddit talk goes. If you've got 6 hours of conversation available about K-Mag, that sounds like a topic for another time. So, joining us today, first of all, you might know him. His name is Blake. He used to work in Formula One. Now he's a streamer. Do you want to introduce yourself, mate? And tell us a little bit about what you used to do in Formula One.
Yeah, sure. So I moved from Texas to the UK in 2011 to get a job in motorsport. I wanted to be a Formula One engineer. So I said, why not? Let's try it. Went to Oxford Brookes University, got a motorsport master's degree, and somehow after that landed a job at Force India. So has become Sahara Force India Racing Point and now is Aston Martin. I worked there for 3 years. Most of that time I spent as a trackside performance engineer working on Di Resta's car and then Perez's car. I then moved to Red Bull Racing. I worked with Kvyat and Verstappen. So I was Verstappen's performance engineer for the first year when he was at Red Bull. Then after 2017, I moved back to the factory to focus more on development and worked in the simulator and the simulator performance engineering group. And then November this year, I decided I wanted to take a break and explore some other aspects of life. So I play mostly Warzone. I play Escape from Tarkov. I make YouTube and TikTok content, and I'm just trying to enjoy life and do something a bit different.
You're a motorsports guy and a gamer. You're literally the coolest person I know, and that's not sarcasm.
No, Kevin, I think, yeah, people confirm Kevin is actually cooler. Much cooler.
No offense, Blake, but he's much, much cooler.
I think so. I'm not even going to argue with you about that.
Okay, so that was a pretty impressive CV. We do have a second guest, and his name is Engine Mode 11. Well, his name's Dan, actually, but you can call him Engine Mode 11. You might know him possibly from Twitter. My understanding is he's now left Red Bull, and he's also doing a bit of streaming. So, Dan, over to you. Can you just tell us a little bit about your role at Red Bull, what it was you were doing, and just about you?
Yeah, so unlike Blake, who had a very impressive sort of journey through university and through other teams, I just lucked into it by being a college dropout. I worked in the financial industry in London, and then, like I say, just sort of lucked into a job at Red Bull as a senior systems engineer. And that translates to glorified IT. So when Blake would break the simulator, he'd probably give me a call.
I also heard you used to make the tea.
Yeah, we're both tea boys.
Yeah, I did coffees. Dan did the teas, and I'm American. I'll mess up tea anyway. So you had to do the teas, but they called me for the coffees. That's what I spent most of my career honestly doing, and I think Dan probably did similar.
Yeah, every time Blake tried to make a cup of tea, he had this overwhelming urge to throw the tea bags into the lake.
Okay, so I just want to double check before we get going. Did you two actually work together? Or is that, do you just know each other post your career at Red Bull?
I think I've crossed paths with Dan a couple times in the office, but it was kind of like not until really after that we started conversing and chatting.
Yeah, like obviously we knew each other was, but then it was like, someone said to me, oh, you know, Blake's leaving and he's streaming. So I started checking out his stream. And then I said, oh, yeah, I'm leaving too. And then sort of this weird sort of post-Red Bull support group formed between us. But yeah, no, we have sort of like crossed paths briefly. But there's like 1,000 people in the company. I mean, I was there for 6 years and there were still people that I'd see every day. And I don't know who their name was.
Yep, absolutely that.
Wow. Okay. So before we get going with some of the Q&As, and the way we'll do it is we'll start with some of the questions that we'll put on the subreddit. So Jeppe will just kind of pick a few to ask. And obviously we'll go to you for answers. And then we'll ask people who are joining in, if you just put your hand up and we'll bring you in as when we can. Just in terms of housekeeping, of course, we've got some strict mod rules on the sub. Don't say anything on here that you wouldn't say if you were on the sub. Be kind, ask away. Jeppe, do you want to start with the first question, if you've got any lined up?
I do. I've got plenty lined up. And for some reason, people are very preoccupied with the food in the paddock. So let's start up there. What's the worst food you've ever had in the paddock or at the factory?
Oof. Dan, you want to hit this one first?
Yeah, I wasn't trackside. I wasn't particularly fond of the, remember that pasta they did before the catering unit was up fully running at winter testing?
Yeah.
They had that like sort of generic tomato pasta. And I got so sick of that. It was like the worst thing every single year, knowing that on the Tuesday or the Wednesday, you were going to eat this generic pasta. And then in terms of like back in the factory, I think it's when COVID first hit and they shut the canteen and gave you like these generic meals in boxes.
That was grim.
Yeah.
It slowly got better when they realized like, man, this is actually not much fun. But I think, yeah, I don't think anybody had much fun once COVID hit.
No.
I think right. the thing I liked the most, I've got to say, seriously, so at the energy station, they always had an ice cream stand at the European races in the summer. And they made the gelato fresh in the energy station. And some of the flavors, like the Nutella and the pistachio, all of them were spectacular. But they were, you know, these were artisanal and fantastic treats. So when it's lunchtime or something, the food was good. The catering was excellent. I worked through that food pretty quickly just to in hope that they had some pistachio gelato left. Oh my god! Oh my god!
I think that speaks to most people when I say I didn't have artisanal on my bingo card for this talk.
Yeah. They it was excellent. They do have the catering at the Red Bull is spectacular.
Did you ever get to have any of the sushi from the Honda trucks?
No, I'm just some performance engineer rat. They don't. Yeah, I'm just.
No, saying. I didn't have any either. I just heard it was from others in the team. It was stuff of legend.
Hi, nobody. Nice to meet you. I'm also nobody.
But speaking of the food, one of the other questions was, does anyone actually drink Red Bull in the paddock?
Yeah, plenty of people do. Yeah, absolutely.
What about the factory? I've never been to the Red Bull factory. I've only been with Renault, and they definitely did not have Red Bull at the factory. But I heard rumors that they're just freezers or coolers all over the place filled with Red Bull, so you can just keep going all night when you need to rebuild the car after Max crashes out or something.
Well, why was it just Max that crashed out? Is that a pointed statement? I'm just kidding. No, there's Red Bull fridges literally all over the factory. Yeah, and they've got not just the standard classic and the sugar free, but the tropical flavors, some of the unique flavors, some of the flavors you don't get in the UK, some of the like flavors that came from the European markets. Yeah.
So they have Red Bull Zero, which I believe is something Dan invented after
the meme lord himself.
Oh yeah, the Red Bull Zero. Yeah, yeah, and that's a new edition they're going to bring out.
I don't think that one's going to be very popular.
If I'm wrong, but that's the flavor you can only have when there's a double DNF, isn't it? So
yeah. Yeah, it's been the first one since Baku, wasn't it? And that was, yeah. Yeah.
We obviously need to touch a little bit about what happened on Sunday. So we need your insider information. What do you think went wrong at Red Bull this weekend?
I think me and Blake don't work there anymore.
Yeah. So as far as if you want the juicy, juicy stuff, I can't call anybody. I've been looking through the Reddit, looking at the discussions today, and there's a bunch of people with some probably fairly good clued in things. I think over the weekend they were talking about fuel primer pumps. Dan even did a piece on that. Why don't you? I think that's the best we know, unless they've said that that's not actually it and it's something else.
Yeah, I don't think there's like an official reason yet. But of course, let's wildly speculate and assume, because, you know, we can do that now. The FIA apparently have got some concerns, and some of the teams have got concerns with the fuel primer pump not being able to deliver the remaining fuel when the tank's quite low. there was an article that went out from the FIA post qualifying, which allowed the teams an extra hour in Parc Fermé to inspect the primer pumps. Now, apparently McLaren were one of the teams that elected to change theirs, whereas Red Bull apparently didn't. And then lo and behold, towards the end of the race, low on fuel, both of the Red Bulls conk out. But that's just wild theory, so I don't know for certain.
It'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend, because both of those DNFs happened after a safety car. And it just so happens the track we're going to is the fastest street circuit in the world. I think, you know, last year there were two red flags and a safety car, so you never know. I just want to remind people who are joining in, if you want to ask a question to our two former Red Bull guys, stick your hand up and we'll make you a speaker. Before that, I did see a question earlier that I'll ask both of you. What was it like to work at Red Bull? What was the working culture like? Because, you know, this was a team in the 2000s, which was, I guess, a bit of the party team that had serious ambition to win titles. So from your time there, yeah, what did you make of the work culture?
I thought honestly, I've only worked at two teams in my career. I worked at Force India, which was a very hardworking small team that had to be very efficient and calculated and conservative everything they did because they didn't have a lot of cash. But again, a great small team environment. You know, you felt like one of the people making a difference. Fast forward to Red Bull, I felt very much the same thing. It was just like the same, everybody pushing in the same direction. More money, more resource, so you could throw a bit more firepower at your problems that you had, for example, and be a little bit more explorative, let's say, and, you know, sometimes scattergun through a lot of different solutions at a problem and see what worked. The culture and everything else, it was awesome. I don't have anything to complain about. I didn't leave because I didn't like working there. I left because I wanted to do something else. Like, there's no blame culture when something goes wrong. Everybody figures it out. Nobody gets thrown under the bus. I thought it was a great place to work, and I honestly, if I went back to motorsport, I would consider going back there.
Out of interest there, when you jumped from Force India to Red Bull, was there a noticeable shift in like, wow, I'm going to one of the big teams?
Yeah, I think that was mostly self-imposed though, because, you know, I'd only been in the industry for a couple of years, and you look up and down the grid and you're like, that's a winning team right now. Obviously, the first year of the V6s, the Mercedes was pretty impressive and, you know, spectacular. But yeah, it was going from one of the midfield teams to going to work for one of the big boys. And yeah, I mean, at the time I took the job going to be Seb's performance engineer, and then obviously Seb went to Ferrari that year that I joined the team. But you know, it felt like a big step, and like that was the shot, you know.
Wow. Yeah, so you went from expecting Vettel to getting Kvyat. That's a bit of a, I'm not saying that's a downgrade, but yeah.
It was different. There was a lot of things that also changed in the background that I don't really want to go into. But at the end of the day, like, I had an awesome time working with Danny. He's one of my favorite people and a genuine dude. And everybody worked together. It was a good place. Honestly, I don't have anything negative to say about it. I see a lot of people talking and, you know, throwing like, oh, it's a terrible place to work and all that. It's like, what do you guys know? Come on, man. It's like, ask people that work there. It's a good place to be.
Yeah,
Dan, I know you've seen comments on Twitter in the past that you've kind of reacted to. By the way, we have just invited the little cancer to ask a question. But before that, Dan, I've seen you interact with people on Twitter who'd say, "Oh, you know, Red Bull's a toxic place to work. It's not enjoyable," and you've always spoken very highly of it.
Yeah, like, you know, I echo everything Blake just said. It's difficult for me to compare it to a different team because it's the only team I've worked for, but I know plenty of people that have left Red Bull, gone to another team, and then have messaged me 6 months later saying, I didn't appreciate just how relaxed it is at Red Bull.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely in the early 2000s, it was definitely the party team. And then as the team found success, the team starts looking, you know, they're not throwing all these huge, crazy parties, but most of the teams aren't. The whole sport is getting so much more serious. The schedule's getting more condensed. There's a lot more work on, and it's not sustainable to goof around that much. And they're a serious team. They're taking everything very seriously now, but that doesn't mean it's not a great place to work.
Absolutely. And to be fair, like, I mean, I grew up in Milton Keynes. I happen to know a couple of people whose like family worked at Red Bull, and they all say the same thing. Right. So we're going to try out this whole inviting people to ask questions. I think we've got the little cancer.
Hello.
There we go.
Did it.
There we go.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. Honored to be the first speaker over here.
Do you get a t-shirt for this?
We're all getting commemorative tattoos after this.
I'll get like a shit post from Dan, perhaps, like making fun of how I speak or something. I don't know.
No, you're fine. You're fine. I only love
you, Dan.
Like,
don't worry.
I hear Dan typing right now, so that's probably the shit post.
That's not no. Honest.
So, first of all, I wanted to. I unfortunately don't know really anyone except for Dan, and that was the first part here. Is I wanted to say thank you. I'm a Drive to Survive introducee. That's like how I found out about it, watching the 2020 season on Netflix, and then I was like, oh, this is cool. And then I watched the 2021 season live, and just through Twitter topics, you did a tweet or something that really blew up. And after the tweet, you wrote like, oh, hello, all the new followers. You know, I'm Dan. I just shitpost sometimes. But I really enjoyed sort of your vibes. And that's been like it's been a big enjoyment factor for my sort of watching Formula One, seeing what you post, and then seeing like the people that follow you and sort of becoming part of the Formula One community. So that's been really, really cool. So thank you for your vibes. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I was just curious, how big of a part did you have in the development of the Red Bull 2022 car? Or did you have any part at all?
Yeah, so it's so how do I answer this one? So the quick answer would probably be no. And then the long answer would be yes, because in the background, I was upgrading and maintaining all of the design systems and the wind tunnel and the CFD cluster and things like that. So I didn't directly have any input in the design, but the stuff I worked on enabled that design to happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's cool.
Yeah. So that my role is how I describe it is it was more sort of a top-down view on the business. So I can't tell you anything about aero or mechanical engineering apart from if something is on fire, that's bad. But I worked with all the parts of the business to ensure all the systems were up and running and you know, upgrades and things like that to enable the design and the manufacturing and things like that. So yeah, it was more of a high level sort of looking down role.
Cool. That's really cool.
Yeah. I think so Blake probably
was going to say there, mate, is in a way it sounds like if Red Bull were to dominate Formula One for 3 or 4 years and they're running out of people to send on the podium, you'd be like, you know, 3 or 4 years into that, they'd be like, right, engine mode, get up here.
Yeah, I'd be like in line with the cleaners.
I think you're doing yourself a disservice there.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, and also, Dan, please, please continue your YouTube channel. I found that really wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Blake, do you want to talk about your contribution to the 2022 car? Hopefully it's the good stuff and not the part that failed on the weekend.
No, that's the reason I got fired. They knew that was going to fail, so they sacked me in November. Now, my last job, I worked in the simulator performance group. So conceptual stuff that was coming, be it aero, chassis, suspension, shaking stuff down, making sure it worked, offering feedback and developing that. I'm not going to go into any detail on that, but from a simulator performance development point of view, we had access to all the stuff and put the car together in the virtual world, test it with the test drivers, see how everything works. And just the same thing that every single team is doing when they develop a new car is, you know, you've got new tires, you've got new aero, you've got a new chassis, new suspension. The suspension system was much more simple. So you go through and work through all the problems and explore the car and see what new problems you might come up with or issues you have from balance or limitations, or I didn't notice that when I was running the simulations offline. That was really what I did. But in terms of the nitty gritty of what actually happened, it was a continuous process that started, you know, dribs and drabs 6-7 months ago in our world. By the time it got to us, that doesn't mean like wind tunnel, everybody else hadn't been looking at this stuff for ages. It gets to us in the simulator and we go through it.
Was that more exciting to like build a brand new car?
It was different. It offered some new challenges and changes. But at the end of the day, once you figured out where the things were. A lot of the problems we were solving were the same problems that we were always working on. Yes, building up a new car in the virtual world is fun and exciting. And it's, you know, it's for example, say you've had, what was it, the RB16B, which was just second year of the same car, more or less. There wasn't that much new and exciting happening with that car. It was more just weekend on weekend stuff for that chassis. But for the new car, yeah, it was cool seeing the different performance windows, how the car needed to operate, and finding those things out from the first time. You know, it was the first time we'd had a new car in 2 years. So yeah, it was much different.
Awesome stuff. Wow, really insightful. I just want to thank the Little Counter for joining in and asking a question. You were the first ever person to ask a question on this talk, so thanks for joining in.
Yeah, no worries, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, dude. I think he needs the tattoo mandatory and the t-shirts optional. No?
No tattoos.
We'll ban anyone who doesn't get the tattoo.
Tattoo's got to come.
You know, you can introduce me to tea as a very American person. That would be my punishment, because the tea seems quite a silly and terrible idea to me. I'm all coffee, so that could be my...
Right, tea is fantastic. I will not have a bad word said about it. All right, listen,
I'll have to try anyway. You know?
I could go into this and get angry about it, but it's all good. It's all good. We're going to move on.
So let's leave that out of it then.
Thank you very much for joining.
No worries.
Yepe, I believe you've got a question from the thread.
I do, and this comes from a user called Rail Games. And remember, if you don't want to have your beautiful voice as part of this talk, you can always ask questions in the comments. We'll pick a few of them up as we go along. So this kind of touches on how much downtime you would get over a 7-day race week. So I imagine it's quite different between being trackside and being back at the factory. So how would a typical race week look for you two during your time in Formula One?
I think, go ahead, Dan. Go ahead, you had this one first.
Yeah, no, I was going to say Blake traveled a lot more than what I did. From my limited experience traveling, there's wasn't really much such thing as downtime, to be honest. I mean, maybe you got to go out to a restaurant one night out of six or something, you know. So yeah, you know, in terms of downtime traveling, there wasn't really much opportunity. And then in the factory, I was quite fortunate in that I could work a regular like 9-to-5 shift, and then maybe the odd support at the weekend in the ops room. So that was more manageable. But yeah, like I say, I'm sure Blake can give his experiences.
I think the track side thing was for an engineers and for most of the people traveling is pretty hardcore. I mean, let's call it a European race. You're flying Wednesday afternoon. You land Wednesday night. If you don't get in late, you maybe go out for a meal and a drink with the team or the guys and gals. Thursday, pretty normal setup day at the track, day zero. You're probably out of there. If there's a sketch or something, you might be out of there at 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, but usually you're out of there by 7 or 8 o'clock. That might include if you've got all your work done going for a run or a cycle around the circuit. That's pretty common to see a lot of the personnel on the weekends, Thursday nights, Saturday nights. Fridays are hardcore. Fridays are 7 a.m. to whatever the curfew is now, midnight or something. Saturday, early start, but you might get out in time to go for a run. And definitely Saturday night, you get time for a meal and drink because there's Parc Fermé and the covers are on the cars from, I think it's like 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening now. Sunday's weird. Sunday looks like show up to work, breakfast, some stuff happens, maybe some meetings, breakfast part two or lunch, it seems like. It's bizarre. And then the race happens, and then it's really glamorous getting changed in the car park and then flying to the airport. And then you're back in the office on Monday.
I have often heard that even though you're rivals, there's quite a bit of like camaraderie between like the different teams, because you know, you're traveling around the world together, you see each other at the airport, you see each other on the track walk. You know, Formula One is often described as being a bit of a circus.
Absolutely.
Did you kind of feel that even though you were kind of rivals and you worked with different people, you were being employed by different companies, you were all kind of in it together, if that makes sense?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, definitely, like, if something, like, super goes wrong, like, people are going to try and help out when they can. But for the most part, like, the paddock is also... people change teams often, especially trackside. So you might see someone that you've worked with at a previous team that's now at a different team down the road, and you might have a chat, or you might go for a run, or you might meet up for a drink on Thursday or Saturday night or whatever. So yeah, that's usually how it goes. You'll meet people that you used to work with that now work with another team, and then you might meet some of their colleagues or whatever. But yeah, there's no like animosity, let's put it that way. Everybody's, yeah.
We all meet up behind the grandstands at 11 p.m. and have a massive fight.
Yeah, where'd you get the trident? Where'd you get the trident from, Dan? That's impressive.
Yeah.
Well, I do actually have a follow up question based on that, but we have another speaker. Strangely, Viggy96. I'm beginning to wonder if you're related to Yepe96, because your avatars are actually quite similar. So if you want to unmute yourself and ask away.
I'm kind of scared to find my clone here.
I don't think we're related, but hey, surprise, it's actually worked. Anyway, yeah, hey guys, just wanted the opportunity to talk to the Red Bull guys. It's pretty cool. I guess really, I've always been interested in the engineering aspect of F1. So I guess some sort of geeky questions, I guess. What sort of hardware does Red Bull use for the CFD stuff, for the CFD cluster? And also, just another sort of question is, was there any sort of culture shift that happened when Red Bull was customer team to Renault versus when Red Bull switched to Honda? I'm not sure when you guys left and if you guys experienced that, but I guess it'd be interesting to hear if there's any sort of culture shift or any sort of difference in the relationship, and I guess if you guys can speak to that.
Great questions.
Yeah, so in regards to the HPC and CFD, that was all run off the back of IBM, because I don't know if we did or do have a deal with them in terms of sponsorship, and then it was all InfiniBand connected, and I can't remember what it was that was serving the data now. No, I can't remember off the top of my head. So yeah, it was all IBM based, and several racks full of kit and a load of InfiniBand to link it all together. I mean, when I left back in November, I think the CFD cluster was pushing 2 petabytes, I think, of data. It was something extreme. So, you know, you're talking racks and racks and racks of kit. It was pretty insane. And then in terms of culture shift from Renault to Honda, from my position, I didn't really notice much of a difference. In fact, I think I'm right in saying some of the Renault performance engineers actually jumped ship to Honda and stayed with us, which I thought was quite amusing. It was all good.
Yeah, I think there were one or two people that did come over to Honda, but at that point I was not at the track. And from a factory performance engineer, the operation of the power unit and that, most of those integrations happen, most of those conversations either happen in the design phase, which I wasn't a designer, I was a performance analysis engineer, and at the track. So the relationship between, for example, you have personnel that travel from the chassis manufacturer, so from Red Bull, and there's people from Honda that travel, so technicians, engineers, and the like. And probably the working environment did change, and they have different nomenclature, different systems. There was also different culture. They went from working with a French company to working with a Japanese company, and I don't know the details of it, but definitely there were some culture shifts in that. Nothing bad that I could ever think of, but no. Yeah, something different. It was different, but yeah.
So follow-up check question to what Viggy asked. This comes from Chris MCLP in the comments, and he asks how much of the software and the IT stack is proprietary, meaning built in-house by the IT team, and how much is third-party software that you bought from outside the team? It's probably mostly for Dan, I suspect.
Yes, in a way. So hardware and things like that, you know, you use all the same network kit and servers as everyone else does, the same tin. But in terms of actual tools and things like that, they are coded in-house or perhaps purchased from McLaren Advanced Technologies, which are, they're the company, like a division of McLaren, and they do all the spec parts, ECUs and things like that for all the teams. And you can, you know, obviously get some software from them as well to assist with that. And then probably simulator wise, again, that's probably a better question for Blake.
I think it's probably best not to go into too much detail about that, but a lot of the stuff was proprietary. And I think it's best just to leave it short answer. A lot of teams will come up with very unique solutions to the problems. They used a lot of McLaren electronic software, so Atlas for the data telemetry, which all the teams use. But a lot of teams will also develop their own data analysis suites, as well as all of the stuff like the models and everything else, which, again, is probably sensitive stuff not worth mentioning.
Okay, so ultimately, it's a lot more complicated than just using R-Factor.
I think some teams will use R-Factor and other products, and I think, but it just depends on the scope of what the teams want to develop. But yeah.
Blake just doesn't want to officially answer that we actually be using Outrun 2.
What a game.
How's the balance? Yeah, it's pretty good. The resolution's not great. It's like, no, shut up, keep driving. 10 more laps.
Love it. Right. Viggy, hope that answers your questions. Thank you very much for joining.
Thanks, mate.
And we're not going to ask you to get a tattoo. That was only for number one. So if anyone else has a question, Yeppe is going to just try and sort a few things out and give someone speaker access. But until then, I've got a follow-up question. And this is for you, Blake, actually. We know the calendar is getting bigger. We know there are more and more races. And I could only imagine it's grueling having to travel to that many events. Occasionally, I do see comments from people on Twitter saying, well, you know, hundreds of people would want that job. They've got the dream job. They can't complain about having to travel 22, 23 weekends a year, which is nonsense. You know, it's obviously very tough. Mm. Is that feeling of like fatigue and burnout, is that something that's spoken about a lot? I imagine it must be brutal because, you know, when I was growing up, there's only 16 Grand Prix a year. Now there's 22 and sprint races.
Well, I think there's a few big differences. If you want to talk about the past, in the past, there were T-car teams. You had a race engineer, test engineer, data engineers, all a whole different car build team, which serviced the test cars. And, you know, even further back, you had 3 cars running at a weekend. How long ago was that? Jeez. But like now, you're 23, 24 races a year. Not very many tests, but you have stuff happening like triple headers. What is a triple header? Like, seriously. So as far as the longevity of traveling personnel, and I don't think people also appreciate, at every race, there are a number of people who offer factory support throughout the whole weekend. So just because they're not at the track does not mean they're not working weekends. Those are IT, those are electronics, they're systems people, they're controls engineers, they're engine people, they're aerodynamicists. They're at the factory working the same hours as the people at the track. The people, I think, for the most part, people that say, oh, that's a dream job, I would do it, are the people that probably wouldn't last very long doing it because it's insanely stressful, it's high pressure, it's a lot of work, and it's nonstop. So yeah, I don't know, man. It's pretty hardcore. And that was my motivation for stopping traveling is, you know, I'd spent 6 years in a row of my life, spent most of those years on the road. Like there's people that love it and it's their life. And I just happened to realize that I loved it, but it wasn't going to be my life, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, and it doesn't surprise me to hear you say that because it's all well and good going to a Grand Prix, but when you're working in it and there's pressure on you and you're spending so much time on planes and in hotels, you know, in beds that aren't road, it must be quite difficult. I used to work at Formula E, not to any level of stress or intensity that you did.
I don't think it's that far away, man. I seriously think like the weekends are shorter, but it's still the same kind of thing. You're in and out of hotels, airports. People think you're going all over the world, seeing all the cool places. Yeah, you do get to see some cool stuff, but you're looking at 24 to 28 weeks a year away. And like, you know, I spend probably another month of my time every year back in Texas with my family. So, you know, to go see my parents and my brother. So it's like, great. You're looking at something like, 36 weeks a year away from wherever your house is. It's nutty. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens because I'm just talking about the engineers, the mechanics and technicians and stuff have even longer. The people that go up and set up, tear down, prep the cars all weekend. It's mental.
Before we move on to Need for Cars, who just invited, can I just ask then, was there a specific moment where you traveled to a race and, you know, you saw, oh god, I'm traveling across the world again on Tuesday? Was there a specific moment you remember where you just thought, right, I can't do this anymore?
Nah, not really. And it wasn't one of those I can't do this anymore. It's just one of those I don't want to be 3 years further into this thinking, you know, being honest with yourself, you know, in the back of your head, it's like, right, I'm not as crazy about this as I once was. And there's a lot of really young, hungry people at the factory that want a shot at this job. Why don't I go back to the factory, support them? I can get a little bit of my, you know, my free time back. I get most of my weekends back and everything else and approach from that way. So it wasn't like one of those, like, I hate this, I want to quit now. It was like, I should probably stop now before I get sucked in for three more years and wonder where the time went.
Right. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Thank you very much for your detailed answer. We have just invited Need for Cars. So if you're trying to meet yourself, and you can ask Dan and Blake a question.
All right. Can you hear me? You good?
Loud and clear.
Yeah, loud and clear.
All right. I had a question recently. So I'm a computer engineering major as of late, and I've been looking at design processes and such. How does the team as a whole divvy up workloads and who's designing what part? How does that get divided up, and how do teams get selected for that?
I think for the most part, you kind of start with an impetus for a change. Like what's the change? For example, this year, two big things, aerodynamic regulations, tires. So you've got a lot of aerodynamics work going on. You've got a lot of packaging work going on, and those are driving most of the changes. And then from those changes, you're going to your suspension and performance group saying, right, we need the suspension that does this, and Aero wants the suspension legs like this. Back and forth iterative process, you know, defining goals and targets at a performance level. Like, what do you need the car to do? Okay, we can only tolerate this much. Iterate. You know, stuff like, for example, the steering wheel and electronics. Those are decoupled from those kind of problems. You know, the aerodynamic regulations and the wheel change don't really impact the steering wheel. So some stuff stays the same. And then you've got very strict groups allocated to doing, you know, sections of the car aerodynamically, surfaces, flows, cooling. You've got suspension people doing how the things work mechanically. You've got stress people saying, right, are these things strong enough for the loads we think we're going to take? The vehicle dynamics people are telling them what the loads are likely to be given what they know about the tires and aero and everything else. So it's this huge kind of like circular process, but there's usually a couple that your chief designer and the deputy and then heads of department will often kind of correlate all that information, discuss what needs to be done, divvy up the work down the chain to their subordinates. The car will end up in the simulator at some point and they'll say, okay, well, we had a question about this thing. Will this work? Will this car handle well? And the simulator group will come back and say, possibly yes, possibly no, with some varying degree of certainty on how much they trust the current aero map and the current tire model and everything else. And everybody has a discussion and technical director, chief designer, somebody else get involved and say, right, here's how we're going to step forward. Do we agree on this? Does this seem reasonable? Iterate again and again and again. I think it's a lot more streamlined than that. But in general, for the most part, that's how the processes go. There's so many back and forths between aero and everything. And a lot of the time, this stuff is completely dictated by the regulations. You see, a lot of the cars in certain areas look very similar. Those things are quite prescribed. Then you have teams like vastly differing, you know, shapes of their car between the Ferrari and the Mercedes, for example. Those are different interpretations and maybe even solving different problems.
Great. Does that kind of answer your question there, Need for Cars?
It does. And another follow-up question. Do teams ever talk to each other about potential solutions to major issues they're having, especially with the, I guess, the porpoising issue that's come up in this season? Do you think teams are talking to each other about potential solutions while keeping their own ideas under wraps? Or is that something that's strictly like, okay, this is ours, we're not talking about it, we're keeping it under wraps?
I think in general, like a discussion of technical issues that are between teams are, first of all, not allowed. And they have to be very careful about that. And I think for the most part, most of the teams probably have a pretty good idea of what's causing it, whether or not they have the capacity at the time to solve that problem is a different story. You know, whether they have the tools in their box or the flexibility in their design to alter that. What we'll see in the next couple of races.
Just seeing you unmute yourself, Dan. Did you want to chip in there?
No.
Oh, you had us all hanging. Okay.
Sorry. No. I think, like Blake said, I think we're all quite happy enough to go out and maybe have a beer together. But in terms of talking about solutions between the other teams, you know, I can't see. Well, A, it's not allowed. And B, I can't see it happening anyway.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't go far further past. It's like, so That porpoising, eh? Yeah, cheers, yeah. Mate.
It is funny, actually. I do think porpoising is the first time I've ever seen in F1 there'd be an actual like issue affecting loads of teams that's caught them by surprise. It'd be interesting to see how that resolves itself. Need for Cars, thank you very much for joining. And I believe, well, actually, before we go to our next guest, we were originally planning to kind of go for about another 45 minutes. So we'll keep going until we've run out of questions or until we hit, or it'll be 9 p.m. UK time. So in 45 minutes. Right, I've got no idea how to pronounce this. Is it BU F1?
Yeah, BU F1. So my question kind of was answered earlier, but to the people at McLaren right now, you know, maybe Williams, Aston Martin, for mental health issues, you know, when you're at the bottom, didn't expect it, you know, happened with McLaren in 2015, Ferrari 2019, 2020, for engineers, anyone who's having like a hard time, I mean, even Red Bull with you guys hoping to win a world championship just to, you know, every year. I believe it's, you know, it's, you always want to win a race, but you want to win that championship. What did you do? Was it, you know, going out to get a beer? Did you follow F1 when you weren't at home? Were you, you know, watching football or, you know, just wondering about that?
I think a lot of it, like, if you, what better motivation than showing up from an off season and being kicked in the gut and having a very poor performance on a weekend to motivate you to work even harder? That's the way I look at it. And I think a lot of the people will, and they're probably going to be down. Like, double DNFs suck. Back the grid, when you feel like probably, and like everybody in general probably feels they shouldn't be back there. It's like, what are they doing? What's going on? It's probably motivating. I think they'll turn it around. They're probably stressing right now, but it's a pretty good motivator. And as long as you have good leaders in place to say, don't worry, guys, we'll take care of this and not just start freaking out, which I think they probably do. I don't know. Like in terms of I don't think people take stuff too personally. Like, yeah, probably the technical director and the chiefs are a bit stressed, but they're going to be conveying a message of, let's get together and work this out. And they're going to be coming up with plans, having meetings and talking to people and hopefully listening to their experts and getting ready for the next race.
Yeah, I can speak in relation to the mental health side. And I've always tried to be quite open about it on my Twitter. And there was a period where I was really low and I was really struggling. And, you know, Red Bull were super supportive, you know, in giving me whatever time I needed, you know, allowing me to go off and have counseling for an hour a week or whatever. You know, there's phone lines that they provide that you can call to have 24-hour access to a counselor. So, yeah, you know, I think mental health is an important part of it and, you know, we shouldn't have the stigma around it. But, yeah, all I can say is, you know, I'm fine. Red Bull was super supportive and, you know, I'm always open for a chat if anyone needs it.
Just as a follow-up to that question from Bob, actually, last year, Dan, when the title fight was getting really quite kind of messy between two sets of fan bases, as someone that worked at Red Bull, logging on Twitter and seeing those kind of things said, how easily was it to kind of detach yourself from, you know, the guy that works at Red Bull, an F1 fan, and also seeing a lot of people very angry online about certain things? Yeah, but how was that experience for you? So I know a few times we messaged about it and just both found it a bit frustrating.
Yeah, so like you say, it's frustrating, but it would never affect me like personally too much because at the end of the day, you know, it's Twitter. Anyone can just stick 140 characters into a tweet or whatever it is and just hit send. You know, it sort of enables that toxicity. And, you know, I just laugh half the time at them, to be perfectly honest. You know.
Great. Yeah. No, sounds good. That's certainly the approach to have, I think. Bo, thank you very much for your question. I think Yeppe wants to jump in because he's got one. So, do you want to ask away?
I do. I just have a comment from a user called Tessie Boys, and he just wants to say, Engine Mode 11 has a very soothing voice, like bedtime story soothing. So, Dan, I think we may need you to start recording audiobooks. Or
yeah, I've heard this. People, since I started my YouTube and that, people have been like, oh, you've got a really nice voice. I'm like, really? I just sound like I'm really bored half the time, you know? But I'm not, honestly. I'm having a great time. I just always sound really bored.
I think we need to get you set up with some audiobook.
Yeah.
Stuff. Well, I can have you on audio.
It's
on
done. Audio. The, just give him the contract. Sign the thing, man.
Sign the thing, yeah. It's just whatever number he wants.
Alternative exactly. F1 commentary.
I'll definitely watch that F1 TV channel with Dan commentating.
Well, absolutely. So would I. Dan commentating.
I do have a question for Dan. So Dan, you left Formula One and went to a more traditional kind of occupation. You now work for Cisco, if I'm remembering correctly. How was that transition going from working at a Formula One team to working for a company like Cisco?
Yeah. So it's obviously Cisco is a vastly larger company than Red Bull Racing. So there is sort of getting used to being just a number again, if you know what I mean. But a lot of the knowledge and lessons learned and things like that do carry over quite well into my new role. I'm a delivery consultant now, which basically means I'm currently working alongside the British National Health Service and a couple of universities to sort of bring their systems and whatnot up to speed with the lessons and that I've learned from F1. So it wasn't a great difficulty to adapt. I think the hardest thing for me, which is probably slightly unrelated, is having to watch F1 without having access to telemetry.
That's actually the most heartbreaking bit, I think.
I know, right?
So having been in IT, you didn't install a backdoor or something?
No. I'd never do such a thing.
With your friends and at our Formula One?
No, I'd never do such a thing.
Oh. 50 quid on PayPal. I'll send you the email address. He's got it. I've got it.
Okay, so both. Can I just ask, actually, now that, because you still technically have speaker rights, is there anything else you want to ask our guests? Or,
you know, just going on, you know, random thing, you know, because we're always into F1 racing games. Would you ever, I see they're making a team manager game. Would you ever want an engineer-based Formula One game? Would that be fun? You know, just asking out of my ass, honestly.
I think it would be super cool. I don't know how many people would be that interested in it. Like most of the games are fairly appealing to a casual audience. Like, I don't know, maybe the Motorsport Manager, if people are into that, fine. You know, Race Engineer 2022, are people into that?
It'd be a good way of putting people off.
Yeah, it's like, wait, so I'm the clipboard holder, tire pressure, babysitter guy.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody I said that about them.
To be honest, I would definitely check out that game.
I would play it.
I just feel like I see most people always more interested in that aspect, just maybe because Reddit, you know, that type of fan base, we're into the technical part. But yeah, I don't know. I see it on Twitter. I see it on Reddit. I, you know, who knows, those weird niche games.
Yeah, I think maybe me and Blake could come together and make a game where you simulate being in a design office and all you're doing is just scanning Adrian Newey's documents into a PDF format.
I would totally play that, and I'd also watch like speedruns of it as well. So,
oh yeah, I think there's a whole new niche for Twitch live streaming content as well. No backseating, all that on Formula One Race Engineer 2022, and there's a mini game of Formula One Design Engineer / Barista 2023 coming out as well.
Absolutely,
I'd right. play that. Yeah, I mean, if they play Farm Simulator, yeah, I'd play that.
All right. I'll let you guys know when it goes live. I'll see you there.
Thank you very much for your question. Right. Whilst
thank you.
Find someone else.
Thanks, bro.
Our pleasure. Whilst the FP finds someone else who's got their hand up, I've got a question for you both, but this is mainly aimed at the Texan himself, actually, Blake, because I used to work in Texas.
No way.
I grew up in Milton Keynes.
No way.
Red Bull put Milton Keynes on the map. So I want to ask you, as a lighthearted question, what did you both think about Milton Keynes?
I just want to say that I am, since being here, I am 300% more passionate about roundabouts.
I know, exactly. People do not understand.
No, honestly, I've got to be honest with you, being an American, moving to the UK, I lived in Oxford for 6 years, and it was a small place. Like, Oxford is a college town. Getting something from the grocery store or hardware store is a task sometimes. It's like, well, I can't have a car in the city, or, you know, getting my car, you know, 2 miles away to this store is a disaster. Whereas Milton Keynes, I've got access to anything I want. The only thing that does suck is, like, if I wanted to go for, you know, most things, I need to drive there. I can't hop on a bus necessarily. Also, because I live outside of Milton Keynes, but it's a convenient city. It's not bad. There's nothing super amazing about it either, though. But there's just nothing. There's nothing crap about it either.
Have you seen the wild conspiracy theory that Milton Keynes was built as a Freemason city?
Really?
No. I subscribe to that now, having just heard it.
So. What do you mean conspiracy theory? That's just spitting facts.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's wild, man. It's proper tinfoil hat. So I fully recommend everyone does that. And
what do you think is at the bottom of the McLaren cooling pond?
I was going to say it was Martin Whitmarsh, but he's appeared now at Aston Martin.
Yeah, that's it. That's I don't.
Yeah, he's been forgiven. Oh well, I'm glad to hear you both have some passion for Milton Keynes. When I worked in Texas, I worked in Fort Worth, and every time I got to a stop sign, I just wished there was a roundabout.
Yeah.
It's a weird place.
You would be shocked if you went back, because actually that's where I'm from. I'm from Dallas, Fort Worth area. The number of times they've started to install roundabouts and the locals don't understand the concept, it's very impressive and even more frightening when you are a cyclist. We'll leave it at that.
Oh, it's incredible. I have seen the memes. Right. I think Yeppe's got a question. Then we're going to go over to another user. So Yeppe, over to you.
I do. This is from the comments. It's from a user called McLaren Alonso, and he's asking, how is Christian to work with? Does the team principal typically interact with most parts of the team, or is it more of a that's the big boss and we don't usually see him type of thing?
I don't really like talking too much about this kind of stuff, because it's like, you know, people see the TV series, they want to see, like, is this person like that thing on TV? But I will say, he's always in the factory. He's always walking around, always asking how people are doing. At the track, you probably interact with him. I interacted with him a lot more when I was at the track. But I think what you see is what you get. Direct dude, passionate about what he does. Pretty awesome team. He's the boss. And
Yeah. I think he appreciates a good bit of shithousery as well.
I do think, actually, Dan, I think you put up a tweet that went semi-viral about Verstappen, because someone was talking about, you know what, I bet he's not great to work with. And you just said, actually, he's very down to earth and just a bit of a nice guy. And I guess ultimately, these people are just human beings. And
Yeah, Blake would have worked with him a lot more than what I did. But in my very sort of brief exchanges with Max and things like that, you know, I thought he was sound, you know. He wasn't, there was no ego with him, you know. He was like talking to an old friend sort of thing, you know.
I think one of the probably downsides of Drive to Survive is they like to paint certain people in certain lights and only highlight certain aspects to help fulfill the narrative of the story, which is their, you know, the creative license they take on some of the stuff, which is fine. It makes very interesting watching, but at the end of the day, I don't think it's fair sometimes. And I think he's even commented on that, but the dude's a nice dude. He's passionate about what he does, but he's also direct and to the point. And I appreciate that in some people, and some people just don't like that.
Absolutely. And I think it is just a tendency in kind of sports fandom of the team you support are the good guys. Therefore, anything said by the opposition that I disagree with, you know, they're the villains, they're the bad guys. And
absolutely.
Ultimately, these are just professionals trying to do a job. So, okay.
But that's part of it. And that's what makes it what it is, isn't it? And it's fun. Just, absolutely. Yeah, but some people just take it a little bit too far. It's like, hey, just knock that back, like, from a 9 to like a 6 and everything will be fine.
Absolutely. Like, if I see a quote from a footballer that I like, I'm very defensive about it. But if that exact quote was said by someone on a different team, I'd be fuming. Yep. And it is just how sports fandom works. So,
perfect example.
So I think we're going to try Dread Pirate Roberts. I hope that's your username. I can't quite see all of it, but if you could try and unmute yourself and ask a question to Dan and Blake.
Hey. Thank you so much for putting this on. I really appreciate it. I'm actually at work, so instead of listening to a podcast, I'm just listening to your guys' conversation, and I really appreciate the insights. I was actually looking at Blake's LinkedIn earlier, and I saw that he participated in Formula while at college. So
Oh, unfortunately, we've just lost your audio. The fact that you said you're at work makes me wonder if someone's had a peek and you've had to just mute yourself.
Busted.
No, I don't know why I got logged out there, but can you guys hear me okay?
Yep. Yeah, loud and clear.
Sweet. So I was looking at Blake's LinkedIn profile earlier, and I saw that he participated in Formula while he was in college. So I was just wondering what the correlation of the learning while being at college was with the first team, the Sahara Formula One team that he went on. Any correlation between those organizations or programs?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's an awesome question. And I'm surprised somebody asked about Formula SA or Formula Student. So basically what Dreaded Pirate Roberts is asking is Formula Student or Formula SA is a collegiate design competition. It's at universities in America and Europe and actually all over the world. South America is one of Formula Student, Brazil, Japan, Korea. So it's a design competition. So there's several different types of it. But Formula Student is an excellent platform because at most traditional engineering universities and schools, you do not learn very many automotive or even motorsport principles. So it gives you something most often it's outside of the curriculum of the university. It might be a course or special credit, but in my instance, it was completely volunteer and I spent a substantial amount of time on that. And that was kind of what started this passion to try and get a job in Formula One in the first place. So I learned a lot. Did it help me get a job? Absolutely. Was it necessary for me to do Formula SE and Formula Student in order to get a job in Formula One? No, it wasn't. But it helped me learn a lot of stuff at a introductory level. I learned a lot of design stuff, which I haven't used in ages. It was honestly, I'd love to talk about Formula Student for hours on end. I know a lot of people from Formula Student who are in Formula One now. I'll put it that way. And I know lots of people who did not contribute any to Formula Student or Formula C from the universities who are also in Formula One. So if anybody's interested, definitely look around on the internet at Formula Student, Formula C, if there's any young people that are interested in that kind of career path. It's something you should definitely consider. I'll put it that. I think it was spectacular. It's one of my favorite experiences from university, both in Texas and in the UK.
Makes sense. Thank you.
No, no worries. You don't sound like a pirate at all, just FYI.
Yeah, I'm not.
I love the idea that someone has to clarify that they're not a pirate.
That needs to be in your bio. That has to be in your bio, FYI, not an actual pirate.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
What are you doing?
Thank you very much.
If you're not a pirate, what's your job?
Oh, he's gone.
He's gone. There you go.
Just so you know, we are having some issues here.
Classic pirate behavior.
You've all disappeared.
I can still talk, but I don't.
So next, we're going to go to Semi Socks, who had her. I should say. Do you want some socks? Are you here for socks?
Well, I could always do with some more, to be honest. Also, I think Dread Pirate is a term relating to people who have ADHD. So I think that is what that means.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Oh, very excited to be invited to speak. Hello from Manchester. Thanks. I just wanted to ask, you've made a few comments about I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds perhaps like Red Bull has maybe a bit of an unjustified reputation at times for being a hectic place to work. When you said it's very relaxed, at least some people who've worked with you have said that they didn't appreciate how relaxed it was until moving to other teams. I just wanted to ask you, stemming off from that question about the culture, do you two have a favourite memory of working at Red Bull?
I've got a
favourite memory, I should say.
Go on, Dan.
No, I've just got to try and think, recall this story in my head now to know if I can say it or not. Public forum.
Wow.
I mean, there's plenty where I can't. But my favourite sort of takeaway and thing from working at Red Bull is actually it's not actually F1 related. It's more playing a part in bringing the relationship with Red Bull Advanced Technologies and Aston Martin up and running, and then watching the Valkyrie go from pictures on the screen to actually like a physical vehicle, and then hearing it running for the first time, things like that. Like, I never thought when I got a job in F1 that I'd play a very small part, but a part in a hypercar program. So that was very cool. I'm very proud of that.
I think probably one of my favorite memories was my first test. It was Mugello 2012 before Barcelona. It was my first test, and I learned some valuable lessons. And that lesson was leave when you can, eat when you can. And yeah, long story short, it was my first test, and a couple of the guys were like, oh yeah, we're just gonna stay up. There's control systems engineers. Control systems engineers are known for dicking around for absolute ages. If you leave control systems engineers alone, they will mess with stuff to no end, and they'll fine tune and tweak every last bit. So long story short, the next day started, the day the test started at 7 a.m. It was my first day as a performance engineer. And I was at the track until 4 a.m. with the control systems engineer because I was going to try and learn some stuff. I wasn't going to learn anything from those guys that night. They were deep in the sauce, messing with switches and settings and fuel pumps, and leave when you can. Like, if your work's done, get out. And it was just one of those funny things. I still, to the day, joke with the controls engineers that I was there at the track with, because one of them actually happened to be at Red Bull. He left out before I did.
Yeah.
And it's not a great story, but it's like one of those things. It's like that sits in my mind, is leave when you can. Don't be a hero.
Yeah, and it's like a known thing throughout the team now that if you have a car share with a controls engineer to get back to the hotel, you're going to be in for a bad time, because you'll just be hanging around waiting for them for hours.
It's controllers.
That's brilliant. I do think it is very much the case when you work in motorsport that some of the things you remember the most are when you kind of talk about them, the least exciting.
Yeah, it's like telling that story. It's like so anticlimactic, but it's like the first thing that came to mind, and it's stuck in. Like, I other really cool stuff is that I've got a video of it. Is cycling around the Yas Marina, doing 100 kilometers of Yas Marina, 50 kilometers each direction on Saturday night after qualifying. You can hear the music from all the yachts. The lights are all over the hotel. It's you know what, 35 degrees dry, getting sandblasted for what do we? Yeah. The whole night. That was actually pretty spectacular.
Yeah. So I'll add another one to sort of throw the controls guys under the bus a bit more, because why not? When it snowed at Barcelona winter testing, I can't remember what year that was. I think
that was 18.
18, yeah. Yeah, we were hanging around waiting for controls then. And obviously it was so cold. And I just remember that one of the guys went and took the back seats out of the Volkswagen Transporter, because we were waiting around so long for them. We took the back seats out, set them up where the tires were, and then we were using the tire blankets to keep us warm while we were waiting for them. I remember that, yeah.
Oh, that's incredible. I think we need pictures shared on your Twitter to verify that's a true story.
I probably do have a photo somewhere, actually.
Right, dig it out. It'll be on the subreddit tomorrow. There we go.
Absolutely.
Okay, Semisox, thank you very much for joining. Just a reminder to everyone, we're aiming to finish in around 20 minutes, and we've got a lot of questions. So from now on, when we bring someone in, you can ask your question, and then if I can ask Dan and Blake to try not to take too long to answer, because I want to get to
I'll be super
people.
Quick.
Great. That makes it sound like you're desperate to leave at 9 on the dot. So
no, but the answer is no to everything.
Okay, so we're going to go over to Shapeless Boyd. Shapeless, do you want to just...
Yeah, thank you so much. Question for both of you guys. During those quali sessions, when drivers pull back into the pits, they want to make another run at this. How collaborative is that between all of the different mechanics, engineers? What feasibly and like reasonably can be done in that short amount of time in adjustment? And what's either the most you've seen or been able to do in that situation?
Well, for the most part, you can't, from park firmie regulations, you can change very little. So the changes that you can make are flap angle change, depending on those restrictions on where your tire pressures are. You might be operating at the minimums already, so you might not be able to change those. And if it's tires, those have probably already been set You might be able to do a bleed. And then other than that, most of the stuff in qualifying will be control systems adjustments, such as brake balance, diff, and engine braking, and talking about, okay, use this switch or this toggle for this corner or that. But if you know, if it's one of those things where you're like, last minute, right, we didn't plan on doing another run, it's coming up to the line, we come in, fuel the car, go for the next run, not a lot's going on, and you might even be lucky to show the driver an overlay, you know, if it's one of those super snappy turnarounds. And that's really all it is. The mechanics and everything else, it's a perfectly orchestrated machine. Everybody knows what they're doing. And if it's a fast one, people know exactly what to expect and not what not to do.
That is an unbelievably detailed answer. It would not surprise me if there's some like journalist listening in, he's gonna turn that into an article. That was brilliant. Shameless Void, thank you very much for your question.
Thank you guys.
Thanks, dude. Have a good night.
It's our pleasure. So we've got a question from the comments. So Yepe, we've got do you want to ask away?
We do, and this comes from above D6.067. He asks, how accurate do you find your simulations compared to what we see live on the track during testing, qualifying, and the races?
I think the best answer to that question is they're better than reality every time. It's just simulations are just better. No, I'm just kidding.
Spoken like a true engineer.
Honestly, a lot of the stuff is very close, but you don't model so many of the variables all the time, so you're kind of dealing with a little bit of noise. But for the most part, teams should have very well-correlated simulation packages. New cars will have initially lower fidelity, but as the season progresses, they will fine-tune various aspects of the models, be it stuff they haven't modeled or stuff they didn't know was happening that they needed to add to the detail of whatever tire, chassis, suspension, aerodynamics model that they've got. But the simulations are pretty good. The simulator fidelity, very good. But it's always a moving target, and if it's good, you want it to be better.
And that's where Outrun 2 comes in, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Outrun 3 is in development, but we can't talk about that. Can you actually...
wipe that one.
Yeah, Men in Black. Oh, you can't do that with... Is there an audio version of the Men in Black Mind Eraser?
Yeah, the brown note.
Oh my God.
Wow, okay. Let's move on. Great question, great answer. Charlie Spencer, do you want to just unmute yourself? And then we're going to go to Zexy Magician.
Hey guys, can you guys hear me all right?
Yeah, great.
Yep.
Thanks for joining.
All right. Thank you very much for giving me the chance. But just for a question for the both Red Bull people. So how much input does Red Bull, or how much data does Red Bull get from AlphaTauri over all these years? Because if I remember, the while transitioning to Honda, someone said, from Red Bull said, that we have seen how they work with Toro Rosso back then, and that's what made us do the switch to Honda. So how much collaboration goes behind the scenes apart from the drivers between both teams?
Yeah, so the quick and easy answer is none. It's not allowed. You're not allowed to do any sort of data collaboration or anything like that. And there's, you know, a lot of checks in place by the FIA to prevent that, and a lot of auditing that's in place to prevent that sort of thing from happening. So when someone in the past has probably said, oh, you know, we've seen with Honda and AlphaTauri and we're going to go with them, I think they mean from a sort of perspective of it hasn't blown up all year long, so let's go for them. It won't be any sort of deeper than that, if you know what I mean.
Got it. So, but when Red Bull said they were going to go from Renault to Honda, what was your, like, your initial reactions? Because the year before with McLaren's, they were like the engine you would never choose because they're breaking them down all the time, right? So what was your initial reaction, and did it end up the way you expected? Or
I mean, I was quite excited, to be honest. I am probably a glass half full rather than half empty kind of guy. So yeah, no, I was excited, and obviously it's paid off. So yeah.
Okay. I was super excited as well, and it turned out to be an excellent partnership.
Yeah, it did turn out to be one, yeah. And this is a follow-up question for – this is actually a last question for Happy 96. Ooh. What do you think would be K-Mac's best result? What would be like the Vikings' best result for this year with the Haas?
A win, obviously. If we're talking realistically, mm-hmm. I have high hopes for a podium. That Ferrari engine is going to be – it's going to be a killer engine.
Yep.
Let's just put it like that.
I think that's completely feasible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they said K-Mac was coming back, I was really happy as well. I was like, the Viking comeback, according to Gunther.
Anyone who wasn't happy about that, I'll ban.
Anybody who wasn't happy with K-Mag coming back, can you guys just don't raise your hands?
Yeah, raise your hands and then I'll get to you.
Oh.
Right.
Okay.
Charlie. Everybody's leaving now. Great.
And on that note, Charlie Spence, thank you very much for your questions. Yeah. Just to clarify, if people aren't fans of K-Mag, you are still welcome on the subreddit. Zexy Magician, do you want to just unmute yourself? And yeah, a question for the Red Bull guys.
Yeah, thanks guys again for, as everyone has said, for taking the time to answer these questions. So I'm totally new to Formula One.
Welcome.
But when the pre-race coverage, where they go around the paddock, the track, etc., when Sky Sport is trying to find folks to interview, I find that the drivers in particular tend to have, I guess, cups with very long bendy straws. What's the deal with those bendy straws? Why do they have to be 2 feet long?
Just to get them into the helmet, because once you have your helmets on, they usually drop it in through where the visor goes and into their mouth. So without have them anyway, so they don't have to have two lids on their top, basically. So they, you know, once they've sat in the car and if they have to sit on the grid, their trainer or physio will have had their water bottle. So they've got a big long tubey straw so they can drink from a helmet or without the helmet, pretty much. It does look pretty goofy, doesn't it?
But I've just never seen them drink from that straw with the helmet on.
Yeah, that is fair. You'll see when they're in practice, you'll see them in the garage drinking from the straws in between runs.
In like a really weird sort of sixth degree of separation, I actually went to school with a guy that started the company called Hydro Race that now supplies a whole bunch of the grid with those bottles.
Wow.
It's such a weird sort of connection.
I also love this idea of someone being relatively new to Formula One, and that's the question they've got.
Those are the good questions, man. All the other stuff, everybody Absolutely. Already knows the answer to that.
I bet you everyone that's tuning in or listens to this tomorrow or whenever is going to notice that in free practice at Jeddah.
Yeah.
And they'll make the connection that they'll be, oh, engine mode 11. He knows the people that supply that. So, oh, that's brilliant. Right.
Yeah, I'm trying to get one. I'm trying to get one so I can have it when I'm on stream.
Oh, wow. Get it branded. Right. Thank you very much for your questions, Zexy Magician. I believe Yepe has a question from the comments. And then we're going to go to Senor Duck 96. Another 96.
Yeah, just fair warning. If you have 96 at the end of your username, you're definitely getting picked for questions. No bias at all from me.
This dude is so biased.
No. But yeah, anyway, I have a question from the comments. This is THJC. First thing he says is awesome to have you both here on Reddit. And yeah, this is pretty awesome. So the drivers usually to say the wow, this is F1 moment is when they first hit the brakes in anger. In your respective roles, what was your wow, this is F1 moment?
Yeah, I'll go quickly because mine's very simple and easy. And it was when I first heard an F1 car fire up when I'm standing next to it. That was a very sort of magic moment.
I think mine, that is a spectacular moment. And you, 6 years ago, that was a V8, wasn't it? Or was it V6?
My first fire up was a V8 because it was at a tire test.
Yep. Yeah, and that's quite spectacular. The V6s sound bizarre and cool in their own way. The purists
but
are all
it's
cringing.
Not a V8 though, is it?
No, and it's not a V10 either. I think, in short, mine was my first day of work is in vehicle dynamics at Force India, and I showed up and I spent my first 2 days in the 7-post rig. They were doing some suspension tests on the VJM. I don't remember which one it was, but it was white and orange and green. And it was like, wow.
That narrows it down.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't a spiker or a Midland. So it was, yeah, that was one of those things. It's like, wow, I'm here. Like, you know, as a Formula Student alum, you get the Formula Student car on the 7-post rig or the 4-post rig and check all the suspension and do all the sweeps and tests. And it's like, wow. And then you're like, wait, I'm here. I'm at the Force India factory on the 7-post rig with the race car. There's an actual Formula One car right there, and they're not getting mad when I touch it.
Wow.
I mean, I'll second that. I was with McLaren, Renault, and then Haas for a little while, so you'll never guess what driver I worked for. But yep. I remember being there for a fire-up of a V8, and I'd only ever, up until that point, heard an F1 car on track. Mm-hmm. Which is still very loud, but it's kind of far away. Being right next to it and just feeling that shockwave and hearing that sound is amazing.
You feel it in your chest, don't you?
You
do. Yeah.
Exactly. You've got your ears plugged, but you feel that and it's vibrating your guts.
If anyone ever has a chance to try it, make sure you do. It is an experience for a lifetime.
Absolutely. And going back to the V8, V6 point, yeah, the V6 turbos have some really interesting sounds, but they just don't get you like a V8 or indeed a V10. I actually remember the first time I ever saw a Formula One car in person was at Silverstone, went for qualifying in 2003, and I was sat at Loughfield. And those engines were so loud. I remember on Schumacher's qualifying lap, he was on the other part of the circuit and I could hear every upshift. Yeah, unbelievable. Anyway, I digress. We've got 9 minutes left and we really do want to get through everyone's questions. If you've got your hand up and we don't get around to you, we will try. I'm sure Blake and Dan will be happy for you to kind of just ping him a message on Twitter, but we will try and get to you here. Senior Duck 96, if you want to unmute yourself.
All right. Good evening, gentlemen. So my question to you is pertaining to Bahrain. We saw 3 of the 4 Red Bull powered cars not finishing the race. Gasly's car catching fire. Verstappen having problems in general. And Perez spinning off at turn 1 after, quote, losing the engine. And Tsunoda bringing it home for AlphaTauri, the only Red Bull powered team. So is this like early season teething problems, or could this potentially go a few more races, just not be a good season for Red Bull at all?
I think it's preseason, or I think it's early season teething, and first, I don't know how many race distances they did in testing, but I don't tend to pay attention to testing because I write testing off because you don't really see what's happening until the first race anyway. But it seems a statistical 75% DNF seems statistically significant. But honestly, man, I think we'll see. I think it's just early season teething issues. I don't think they're going to have a crap box. I don't think Honda or Red Bull have messed it up.
No.
But
place your bets on the championship now.
I'm not sure if I'm doing that either, but...
No, Blake. Blake will be reserved, but I'm not. I'm going all out, sod it. And if there's any problems with it, just DM me on Twitter. Send me your hate.
Yeah, all in on K-Mag, right?
Yeah, exactly. Kevin's going to smash it. Honestly, it looks terrible, but I mean, how many times have you seen an absolute disaster in the first 2 races and everything's fine in the end? Oh, I think Honda and Red Bull are excellent, and I do not think they will be able, or they'll be stuck in a position where they've got problems. They're going to figure it out pretty quickly. That's almost a guarantee.
I agree with that. Definitely. Great question. Thank you very much for joining. We're going to go over to, since we're running out of time, we're going to go to Chris MCLP.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah.
Quick. Thanks for doing it first. I have a short follow-up question to something you said earlier. You said you have to get used to watching F1 without telemetry data. There is an API, but I guess you got a lot more when you were working there. Can you tell us just how much more you got, or is that like under non-disclosure?
No, that's fine. No, I think that's fair. So the stuff that you can get from the API is timing sectors and GPS loop data from the actual car, from your own car. You have, I don't like that, but this was my bread and butter, but you know, a lot of sensors, and then you're converting using some clever physics and math and calculations. You're converting that into, you know, more meaningful performance related channels. The amount of data that you generate is substantially way too much to look at in a raw form, unless you isolate it down to a very specific subset of a system or something else. And then even that, trying to boil all that down into meaningful stuff is an art in itself. And turning in data into information is the name of the game. And it's very time consuming and difficult, but yeah, there's, how much time you got is the answer to that. There's so much information. The stuff that you can get from the API is definitely very useful to give you a broad overview of performance characteristics of a car and where people are fast and slow. But to understand actually what's causing that, the telemetry data that the teams have access to, you know, the pushrod loads, which you can calculate thousands of things from. You've got speed sensors, you've got aerodynamic pressure sensors. The amount that you can learn from those things is almost limitless.
Cool. And I assume big thing to do when working there is also like working on tools to work with this kind of data.
Absolutely.
Is that correct?
Okay. Absolutely. Yeah. So coming up with clever methods and how to process the data, how to compartmentalize it, how to look at it, how to highlight things that are important, how to disregard things that are not important. Yeah, that was something that was very close to what a lot of the stuff I worked on from the track and the simulator, and it's probably the most exciting thing, I think, in the entire world. It's pretty cool.
Super cool. Thanks for answering.
Yeah, of course, Chris.
Oh, great question. Right, final question of this talk. We're going to go to quality.
Hey, guys. Thanks for putting this on. Hopefully, I'll get a response with the time remaining. But
it's 7.
Your time at Red Bull, what, from your perspective, what was the hardest technical regulation that had to be implemented into the entire package? And what was the reason for it being so hard?
I don't know if I've got a good answer for that, because most of the time people served me up as like everybody else did all the hard work and we're just like, right, does it work or not?
I think the Halo was probably quite difficult. Probably, again, like I say, same as Blake, I couldn't answer for definite, but it was obviously a lot more weight in a in an awkward place on the car being higher up. So I imagine there's some challenges with that.
Yeah, I think I feel like a lot of teams, like there was a couple bands of suspension systems and methods and techniques people were using, but I don't feel like I feel like a lot of the things that they changed only took away things that were adding, you know, a little bit, you know, most of the big changes are year on year. I really can't think of anything that was like super, super difficult to deal with.
But yeah, what about the illegal Ferrari engine?
Hey, it was never proven. Sorry, I didn't set this down. It was never proven.
I've been waiting the whole night for that to come out.
You know, there was, I don't know if either of you saw, but there was actually a Reddit post from a user an entire year before that broke out. It was a year before, and he said, oh, I happened to be at a pub with a guy I know that works for Ferrari, and he basically predicted this fuel flow tampering thing a year before it happened because he overheard something. And I'd recommend finding that post. It's incredible.
But that means it was happening for that long.
Yeah, well, so he posted it at the beginning of 2019, and it was 2 weeks before Charlie Whiting passed, and the post said that Whiting had approved it to be used, but then because he passed away, when Ferrari got to Australia, they didn't use it, which is why they were so slow there. Wow. Anyway, that's one for another one. Quality, thank you very much for your question.
Thanks.
Sorry, the answer wasn't super exciting, but for the most part, like most of those big regulatory changes that happen, the teams come to grips with them pretty quickly, and it's not like the FIA or the regulations ever throw very many things in the, you know, like out to the teams. It's like, this is not possible, because there's been so much back and forth with your, you know, chief engineers or whoever's in charge of, you know, consulting with the FIA. They have working groups to discuss these things, and people are, you know, passing them back and forth to make sure you don't end up with these situations where you can't solve a problem.
That makes sense. Completely.
Great stuff. Okay, so we've got one final question, which we're going to ask. But before we get there, first of all, I want to thank everyone for joining. We did not know what to expect in terms of people joining. It sounds like it's been a big success. We're going to try and do things like this more regularly, but we're just kind of experimenting with the format. If you have any feedback for us, there is the thread available on the subreddit, so you can say what you liked, what you didn't like, and what you'd like to see us to do in the future. There is also the weekly meta thread, where if you've got any suggestions or kind of ideas what we could do. Of course, the subreddit is a community, so we'll do whatever we can. Right, there was one other thing before I go to the final question. This will be available on demand, so if you only were able to tune in for the second half and you want to go back to the first half, you can do that as well. Right, Yeppe. Oh, no, actually, before we even go to Yeppe, to Dan and Blake, do you want to just give a quick shout out to your own social media channels and, you know, where people can follow you?
Go on, Blake. You can go first.
Long story short, I do a lot of mixed gaming and F1 chatting and streaming content on Twitch. It's Break with 3 R's. It's the same as my username here. I'm also doing some specific Formula One TikTok content at Break F1 on TikTok. You can also find that on YouTube. And then I do Break is gaming content on TikTok as well. That's me for the next indefinite future, is doing content creation as a career and trying to share a lot of the stuff that I've learned and with the rest of the community. I just like talking about this stuff. It makes me super excited, and I do miss it, but at the same time, I got to do some other stuff while I've still got time. And also, thank you guys very much for hosting me, and I'm this is a really cool thing that you guys are putting together, and thanks for taking the time, and everybody else, thanks for listening in. That's, and thank you for your questions. They've been awesome.
Yeah. So in terms of myself, it's Engine Mode 11 on Twitter and YouTube. I'm experimenting with content creation, but not to the degree like Blake is. He's still the MVP there. My favorite pastimes include just shit posting and talking trash on Twitter. So if you're down for that, follow me. And thank you very much, everyone.
It is spectacular. Yeah.
And like Anil said, we have a final question for both of you. This has kind of become a tradition for when we have guests do Q&As and AMAs on our sub. So I want you to think really hard about this. Would you rather fight 1,000 Yuki-sized Maxes or a single Max-sized Yuki?
The latter for me, easily. The latter. So I don't think I'm going to win, but I stand a more chance. I think that one's going to be ferocious for sure.
I mean, Yuki's not very big.
No, but he's scrappy. He's passionate, man. He'll mess you up.
Yeah, I am going to say this. So when I first saw him in the factory, I didn't know who he was. And I honestly thought someone had brought their child to work day.
That is the scoop we wanted on this.
I was like, are you kidding? And they were like, no, it's Yuki. And I was like, oh, shit.
I'm thinking we set up this fight as forget the Saturday night concert at Silverstone. We're just going to do this fight instead.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. I think another great one, especially for the gaming fans, is would you take Max in a 1v1 in Warzone or Yuki in a 1v1 on Apex Legends? I think both of them are not terrible at those games. That might have to happen, actually. I don't know.
I think with my skills, I'd get my ass kicked by both. So
yeah, I think I don't know. I might stand a chance. I'm not sure.
Oh, we'll have to set that up.
Yeah, we'll see.
Honestly, the highlight of this has been finding out that Dan... I just got this image of Dan walking around the factory, seeing Yuki Tsunoda, you know, future Formula 1 star, and thinking he's just like a lost kid or something. That is exactly why we wanted to host this Reddit talk. So but, to both of you for joining, we really appreciate you both joining. We didn't know if this format was going to work or how it was going to work. Up until about 10 minutes before, I thought it was going to be done over video, so I had a quick shave. I had no idea what to expect. So we really appreciate you both kind of joining in, and to everyone that's been listening.
Now, yeah, thank we'll you guys you very time. Much. Thank you very much. It was awesome. I really enjoyed the time and the conversation and the questions, and it was also lovely chatting with all of you guys as well.
Yeah, it was beautiful. It was. We shared a moment.
Oh, absolutely. We shared more than a moment. We shared 90 minutes. Right. Thank you, everyone. And see you over at the subreddit.
Have a good night, guys. See ya.
Thank you.